This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. It is not intended to cause or induce breach of an existing agency agreement.
Hello?
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 This is the Vancouver Real Estate Podcast.
And welcome back to Vancouver Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Scalina.
And I'm your other host, Matt Scalina.
And Matt, I should say host, but also realtors with Oakwind Realty in downtown Vancouver. I am excited about today. We've got Noha Sedki. She is the principal at City Spaces Consulting Limited. This is a company in Vancouver that does consulting work for people that are building nonprofit housing.
Yeah, it's exciting to have Noha on the show. This is something we've never really talked about in our 10 years, right? We focus on for-profit housing on this show. But yeah. This is a huge component of the housing sector in Metro Vancouver. So it's really insightful and useful to have Noha on the show and get the lay of the land. And it's a long time coming and it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah, safe to say it comes up a lot on our show. We haven't really done a deep dive. And I think Noha is kind of the perfect person because she comes to this with a really deep understanding of the history of nonprofit housing in Vancouver and the region. And it gives you a more holistic outlook for housing and some of the maybe omissions that have happened over the years, specifically in the city of Vancouver. And of course, you know, this is something that now moving forward is going to be a major component of the housing landscape. And it is.
Yeah, it is for sure. So stay tuned for that. But before we get to our talk with Noha, Adam, we have the MLA Newswire Weekly.
Yes.
And the MLA Newswire Weekly headline is a pre-sale update brought to you by the MLA Canada advisory team. Adam, I'm switching this up this week. Do you have the headline?
I do. Yeah. The headline is the new year comes with the enactment of new policies. And this basically what they're referring to is, we're coming to the end of the year. I can't believe it. It's almost December. If you can believe it, I feel like we were just talking about the fall market, the start of the fall market. And now here we are coming to the end. But many new policies that have been announced throughout 2024 will begin coming to fruition in 2025, and they're going to have a huge impact, mostly on the pre-sale market. On December 15th, the 30-year amortizations for all first-time home buyers and new build buyers will begin. Additionally, insured mortgages will be allowed up to $1.1 million. This comes shortly after the rate announcement on December 11th. Everyone's waiting for the rate announcement, of course, in December. This will be the last Bank of Canada meeting for 2024. And the combination of these two factors could spur some activity in pre-sale. And we've talked about that. There's kind of sitting inventory. Launches have been pushed off until the spring now. A lot of developers will push pause. And will we see, is this enough to get the ball rolling where we're going to see the absorption rate pick up in new construction?
Yeah. I mean, well, hey, 30-year amortizations is attractive, as is lower rates. So we'll see. On January 1st, Adam, there's also the BC flipping tax that's going to be enacted. This, according to
Emily, anyone like that one? Does anyone like that flipping tax? That is so silly.
But well, anyways, here's the thing. According to MLA, and I think they're right here, this is likely going to affect how investors view the resale market, but not the presale market, largely because if you're buying presale today before it's built, you have more than 2 years for the most part. That flipping tax doesn't apply. So the flipping tax not going to impact the presale market very much, according to MLA. What else do we have, Adam?
Well, the last one is on March 1st, BC Building Code is enacted. So this is any new development will need to follow the new BC building code, which entails larger units to accommodate for accessibility. These changes will increase the square footage of homes and therefore overall pricing as well. Two more, actually. On January 1st, Metro Vancouver DCC fees will increase. This, of course, we've talked about it a lot on our show, will have a direct impact on pre-sales and make pre-sales more expensive for developers to build, meaning prices will become higher and less projects will be viable, which means that, you know, we won't be building the amount of housing that we desperately need in the region. And then on March 1st, BC Building Code is also enacted. This means that all new developments will need to follow a new BC Building Code, which means basically means that larger units have to accommodate for accessibility. It will increase the square footage of homes and therefore likely lead to increased pricing as well.
Well, yeah,
because very much on a price per foot market. So
yeah, so this is interesting, right? So we've talked about four. We've got DCC fees raising prices in the future. We have the building code leading to larger units that will just raise the basic entry level price. We have the flipping tax, which doesn't really have much of an impact, but then we have the extended amortization. So it's interesting. I wonder, there's a lot happening in the new year. Yes. And it's a mixed bag, let's call it that. But it's something
to watch. Well, it's a lot of stuff we've been thinking about, but now it's go time on the new policies. So see what impact they have on the market and stay tuned. Never a dull moment in the Vancouver real estate world.
That's right. And if you like that, Adam, you can subscribe to the MLA Newswire, a daily email roundup of the latest real estate news and market insights. Visit MLAcanada.com to subscribe now.
And Matt, I am getting so much positive feedback on our new site, skytraincondo.ca, Skytrain Condo Living, which is, what is it?
Adam, what Skytrain Condo Living is, it's our new site where we have condos within a certain walking distance around Skytrains and pre-construction condos around Skytrain stations across Metro Vancouver. And the logic is pretty simple. We've had people much smarter than us on this show going back basically a decade, and almost to a person, we ask them, where would you buy and why in the region? And the answer is almost always the same. Transit-oriented development, follow the SkyTrains. That's your best bet. That's where the new communities are. That's where all the buildings happening. And this site basically caters to exactly that. If you're looking for new developments near SkyTrains, if you're looking for a condo near rapid transit in Metro Vancouver, we got you covered. It's Skytrain Living. It's skytraincondo.ca. Check it out. We'd love your feedback. And it's a site we're really excited about.
It's a catalog. It's a catalog of condo buildings. It's like the consumer distributors of just in time for Christmas.
Just in time. That's skytraincondo.ca.
That's not going to be something that makes it into every week's episode for sure. That's
I don't think is consumers distributors. Was that specific to Winnipeg, Manitoba, or was that?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I feel like I'm going to quickly ask ChatGPT where was consumers. But you know what is just on a side note?
Please.
What's happening now is for Christmas, Amazon sends out a catalog, like a toys catalog now.
I haven't seen, they have a hard copy? Because actually, it's funny, Amazon is essentially consumers distributors.
Look at this. Consumers Distributing was a Canadian catalog-based retail chain that operated from 1957 to 1996. You were a big fan in the 50s. I was more later in the 90s. At its peak, the company had 243 stores across Canada, including locations in Vancouver, BC.
Okay. But so, was there a pick-a-pop beside it? That's the question.
Oh, man. Everybody younger than 40 is rolling their eyes and not knowing what we're talking about. So anyways, we'll move on. This episode's amazing. We got Noha on the program. She's a force, and you're going to enjoy this.
Absolutely. Enjoy.
This podcast is sponsored by Marcon, a local family-owned and managed real estate development and construction company that has been around for nearly four decades. Marcon is not only committed to high-quality construction, but it is also making a positive impact in the communities in which it builds, all across the Lower Mainland.
We want to highlight two incredible Marcon projects.
Elmwood, a 38-story tower located at Burquitlam's most important intersection, Coma Lake Avenue and Clark Road. This landmark tower will feature 335 condominiums, over 37,000 square feet of office and retail space, and almost 20,000 square feet of amenity space. Elmwood has been incredibly popular, with 85% sold currently, but they still have a great selection of junior one beds all the way to three-bedroom homes remaining.
For a limited time, you can own a home at Elmwood with a 5% total deposit and 5% purchaser incentive.
Wow, now that's an incentive. Sales Gallery is closing soon for Elmwood. Don't miss your opportunity to own there. Learn more at markon.ca/Elmwood for more.
And Matt, we are also excited about Sohnhouse, Markon's newest community that features a West Coast aesthetic with a more nuanced Nordic-inspired design. Sohnhouse offers 165 junior to three-bedroom homes in West Coquitlam that integrates nature into the built environment.
Register today at sohnhouse.markon.ca. That's sohnhaus.markon.ca. Or visit the display center at Outpost in Port Moody.
Markon, building for life. Okay, so we're here with Noha Sedki. She's the principal at City Spaces Consulting Limited. How you doing, Noha?
I'm doing great. How are you, Adam and Matt?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time, Noha. It's great to have you on the show.
Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
For some of our listeners that don't know you, can you maybe start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
So I'm with a firm called City Spaces Consulting. We are a planning and development firm. We've been around for 40 years. And myself and my partner, Jada Bassi, took over ownership of the company a couple of years ago. So I can tell you a little bit about that if you're interested.
Sure, absolutely.
So City Spaces was established by a pretty dynamic duo about 40 years ago in Victoria. And Linda Allen led more or less the business side of the firm, and then Gwyn ran the development consulting side of the firm. And so that's really what's shaped us, is those two components, the planning, policy, and research and engagement work, and then on the development side, working with nonprofits to help build projects. And we still have that split today. On the planning side, we do a lot of work with local government, with regional government, provincial government, and so on. Lots of community planning and policy work. And then on the development side, we're what we call development consultants in the nonprofit world. And we really help nonprofits walk a nonprofit through their projects from vision through to completion.
I'm just curious. So you bought the company a couple of years ago. Can you tell us how you got into the space? A little bit about your background, how you got into real estate, and how you came across this opportunity and why you jumped on it.
Yeah, for sure. So my story, and I have to say this off the bat, that my colleague Oliver is a big fan of the show and listens to it all the time. And one of the things he likes the most is people's stories. So I would like, having been inclined to like brush over my story, but he says this is the best part. So I'm going to give you a little bit of that.
Go deep.
But yeah, so I didn't have a background in planning so much. I really thought I was going to do international development work, and was kind of stumbled across planning at UBC, where I was applied for a research assistant job with a young professor who was very influential for me. And he really he kind of asked me about planning school, and that's how I ended up discovering it. And so I went to the School of Community Regional Planning and thought I'd still focus on international issues, but really fell in love with housing and human settlement issues, both locally and internationally. And worked internationally after planning school, and then I came back and I was really eager to work in housing. And at the time, so I'm going to age myself here, in 2001, housing jobs were pretty scarce in the municipal planning world, or in general. It was really the dark ages of housing, both on the funding and as well as on the policy and planning side. It was at a time where municipalities really thought that was someone else's responsibility, senior government's responsibility. So there really wasn't a lot of opportunities. And I set up a consulting firm with a good friend of mine from school and tried to get as much exposure to housing as I could. But then City Spaces, which was Victoria-based at the time, decided to grow their office, grow their, build an office in Vancouver. And it was a great opportunity for me to really jump in because City Spaces had been doing housing work for a long time. And I like to say I doubled the office because it went from one person to two at that time. And I've been there ever since. I've been here for 20 years. So Gwyn and Linda were looking to retire and move on. Unfortunately, Linda passed away a couple of years ago, but they passed on the firm to staff, to employees. And it's been 4 years now and it's been quite a ride. But yeah, I think we're holding on true to their legacy and what the firm is all about, but also trying to take it on its own journey in this new stage of City Spaces.
I'm just wondering, Noah, when you left UBC, you went abroad. Did that give you, obviously it would give you a different perspective, but do you remember coming back to Vancouver with a different understanding or a different take on the city? I guess it was a long time ago, so the city looked very different 23 or 4 years ago, but.
For sure, for sure. I mean, I was in Pakistan. So in terms of a context, it was very, very different from this context. I was still doing housing work, but in very extremely urban or really remote areas of Pakistan. So that, I think really more than anything, that was an opportunity for me to learn about myself and where my interests are. I find if you do international work more for you than for anyone else, but there's a lot of growth experientially and just life experience that you can build on. But coming back here at that time, housing issues were so critical, and yet we had very little attention and focus. We didn't have the legislative tools. We didn't have much funding at all on the nonprofit housing side, which is our area that we know the most about. I mean, that had more or less dried up in the 90s, in the early 90s. All of those funding programs had dried up, and municipalities really still thought that their focus would be on, you know, land use, which is housing related, but also mainly roads and infrastructure and transportation and those things. And so there was very little attention. And, you know, well, here we are dealing with the consequences of that
right.
A few decades later. We've had a shortfall of rental supply in general, like market rental, and then, of course, nonprofit housing. And yeah, it's the talk of the town now, but it's certainly wasn't when I was trying to get into housing 20 years ago.
Why do you think there was the glaring oversight for rental housing and for nonprofit housing at that time?
Well, if we talk about the history of the nonprofit housing sector, go back as far as the 40s, there was public housing programs that were run by the federal government. So that meant the housing was built and operated by the government. And then that shifted more and more to housing that's being run, social programs that were run by nonprofits. But in addition to that, there was a big focus and incentives and supports for rental housing, market rental housing, mom and pop investors doing rental housing. And a lot of that shifted to doing a lot more strata condo in the 60s and 70s, but rental housing was still really prevalent, and co-ops as well, which, you know, is not a program that exists anymore. Although we just heard that there is potentially some reinvestment in that just from the federal government. But yeah, by the 90s, for whatever reason, I think there was a thought and understanding, it was ideological, that the market could do it all. The market was that we didn't need to have this kind of subsidy and intervention. That we'd be able to deliver, you know, the range of housing and options that we needed for all members of society through private market housing. And obviously, that is not true. I don't believe in that at all. I think we'll always need some level of government intervention and some subsidy for the lowest income households, for any specialized housing. The market shouldn't be expected to deliver that type of housing. And so there's definitely a space for that today. And I think we've recognized it at all levels of government.
And so maybe just thinking about I think there's a lot of confusion out there about what we mean by affordable housing and nonprofit housing. Can we kind of get a working definition or an explanation of what we're referring to?
It is so important to talk about what we mean by affordable housing. I think that is a starting point, foundation for any conversation, because there's so much confusion. The projects that we work on really range across the entire housing network or spectrum or whatever you would like to call it. So we would do a lot of work in the area of temporary housing or emergency housing, emergency accommodation. That's fairly common. And so there's a lot of groups that, those are funded by a government and they're for people that are experiencing homelessness. But emergency shelters are not housing, in my mind. They're a response to a crisis. They're a band-aid. They're necessary. There's a necessary stopgap, but they're not people's homes. So we can kind of set that aside. That's not what we're talking about. But then non-market housing or nonprofit housing or social housing, all of that, all those definitions include any kind of housing that is rented out below market. And so that can be at very, very low rents for people that are receiving income assistance on welfare, as we used to say. And to achieve that level of rent, you really need a deep subsidy, a deep level of subsidy for those units to be, those homes to be affordable for those households. But it can also be moderate income households. It can be housing for seniors living on a pension or people in service sector jobs, people working in the coffee shops, rents that are geared to that level of income, that household income. But then non-market housing is also housing for professionals like teachers or nurses or people that just can't quite access market rents and be able to cover all the costs of living without spending more than 30 or 50% of their income on rent. And so that those are common benchmarks. Increasingly, we're looking at 50% because the 30% is difficult to achieve. And in reality, those are arbitrary numbers, but it is fairly common. So when we're talking about non-market housing, we're really talking about anything that is rented below market. But with social or nonprofit housing, that's also speaking to who's providing that housing, who's operating the housing. And another important distinction is that we're talking about, in most of what we're talking about, most of the housing that's available in the nonprofit world is for people who can live independently. It's really about just being able to live within your means, but you can live independently. You don't need any support. You're not part of a program. There is also supportive housing as part of this spectrum, but that's for very particular groups of people. Perhaps it's for a single mom that was fleeing a violent situation, an abusive situation, and they stayed in a safe house, and now they just need some time in a transitional housing space where they have supports where they can stabilize and get, overcome the situation that they're in for a period of time. That's to get transitional housing. Or supportive housing could be for people that are experiencing mental health or addictions and they really need support in order to maintain their housing and need help with their daily living. So that's specialized housing, that's supportive housing. That's not generally what I'm talking about in terms of when, the broad strokes of non-market or social housing. Most of the housing that is in BC, there's over 70,000 units that are non-market housing in BC today, more than 40,000 or around 40,000 in Metro Vancouver alone. And the majority of that is in this independent housing where people just need lower rents compared to what's available in the market today.
And you're working, like City Spaces is working across that spectrum that you're talking about?
Yeah. So we are essentially, we're development consultants. We're the owner's representative in the market world. But we're also more than that in that we are involved from the very beginning helping nonprofits and helping them develop their vision and then consider what are suitable site opportunities, do the site analysis, do the feasibility. But really we help shepherd a project through, and we're also advocate on their behalf as they manage their project from a concept all the way through to approvals and completion. So we will work with nonprofits that really we don't have much of a filter other than that we work with nice people that are trying to do important work in their community. So we'll work with any nonprofits that are delivering both residential and non-residential programs. So we've got a neighborhood house project, for example, right now, or we'll work on health-based projects as well. But a lot of our projects are residential or mixed use.
And so just so I understand, and this will be a little ignorant, but the nonprofit has kind of a vision of what the housing is going to look like, and you kind of facilitate that vision. Is that right? Only because when you were outlining kind of the different types of non-market housing, like I'm wondering, okay, is it non-market housing for professionals that, you know, can't afford, you know, that 50% threshold you're talking about in one building, or is it a mixed building, or does that depend on the nonprofit that is building the housing? Like, how does that work?
I love your questions.
So, sure.
So the way that it works is it's twofold, but like you start from the nonprofit perspective. The nonprofit, each nonprofit has a mission or a mandate that they're trying to respond to. They have a group of people that they work with, a group of people that they serve, and they see there, because they work with this population, they see there's a particular need. And when an opportunity arises, they want to build a project for that population. So it may be that a group works primarily with seniors or with women-led households or people with particular health needs, mental health-focused housing. There's very specialized nonprofits throughout the province. And the biggest challenge is finding those sites and making those projects happen. But if there is a project idea, a concept, most of the time it involves land that they are already own, that they are already sitting on, or maybe faith-based groups, churches, et cetera, that are looking to develop their properties. Then it's about making the case for it and doing the feasibility and checking and seeing how they can make a project viable. And then you compete for dollars. And we can talk about that as well, because that's really going to dictate at the end of the day what's going to be the shape of that project. You're very much reliant on public dollars, both the provincial and federal, to help shape the project. And those programs are very prescriptive. And so it's about trying to match those interests in terms of what the nonprofit is trying to achieve in their community, and then also balance it out with all the requirements and there's a framework that the funders are providing.
I'm just thinking, and again, this is more from just the side of the business that we're on, or the real estate business, where you'll see market-based strata with components of nonprofit. Can we talk a little bit about that? Like, does that kind of fall under the same rubric, or is that that's a kind of a totally different apple cart?
It can be. It can be. I think, I think if in order to make a nonprofit housing project work as standalone, separate from a mixed tenure project, as we like to call it, there's a lot of hurdles, a lot of challenges. You're dealing with the some of the same inputs and assumptions as a market project. The volatility of the interest rates, or supply chain issues, or cost escalation. All of those things are factors that nonprofit housing providers are going to deal with for their own standalone projects. And we could, you know, I could walk you through what's involved in trying to all the other factors that are unique to a nonprofit housing project. If it's coming at it from a developer's perspective and they've got a requirement for affordable housing, generally speaking, they've got a lot of things to consider, whether they want to manage those units on their own, or depending on if they're doing a rental project, but then they have to deal with all of the requirements that are put on that project from the municipality, or if they're getting any funding or financing support, then there's likely requirements for that developer as well in terms of eligibility, for example, and maintaining those levels of rents over the life of the building. And so there'll be agreements and covenants on title that will restrict the use of those units. And so that's something that the developer can make a decision about whether they're going to manage on their own, or they will bring on a nonprofit to operate. And so if you're bringing on a nonprofit, then there's all the agreements and decisions that have to be made around that, because a nonprofit is coming in with their own objectives. They're not ready. They don't want to come in at the end of a project and then just manage those 20 units or 30 units. you know, for that to work for them, it has to respond to their particular set of needs and their goals and objectives as well. So ideally, you'd want a nonprofit to be involved fairly early in a project so that they could potentially have access to some of the funding that they might need to be able to make that deal work. Maybe they'd be able to draw on federal, provincial dollars. But to do that, it has to respond to all of their own requirements. So the funding programs out there often have, you know, if you think of CMHC, for example, there's the accessibility and energy requirements and also population group requirements. So in order for that funding to come in for the nonprofit portion of the project, they'd need to be able to meet all of those requirements. And they're often tiered. So the greater the affordability or the greater the accessibility, then the you can maximize the funding that way. So there's a lot of things to consider from that the nonprofit would want to be part of those, would want to be part of those that decision-making early on. And then, of course, there's all kinds of decisions that you'd want to make. Is it, are they separate airspace parcels? Is it integrated? And then who's paying for what? At the end of the day, you're going to have cost sharing or service agreements to put in place. And so taking the time at the outset to figure out what that deal looks like and the legal agreements, the service agreements, and really taking the time to shape that is fairly important, I think, for that project to be successful. But if you think about post-occupancy and all the challenges that you deal with in managing a building, you know, if you take the time up front to figure these elements out, then the greater success you'll have. So that's my little plug, is that if you're going to involve a nonprofit, bring them in early and don't assume that they're going to love your project at the 11th hour just before you finish.
In that same vein, Noah, in thinking about something like a recent project that you've worked on that you're excited about, can you kind of walk us through the process, kind of soup to nuts?
I'd love to tell you about a project that recently finished. It's actually, I think for us, the projects that are most interesting are often challenging and complex. But a project that I finished that we just recently completed and toured, and a lot of folks are going around and touring, that would be, you know, encourage more people to go and visit it, is a project we finished in Burnaby with a group called L'Arche. And L'Arche is a very small society that works with people with developmental disabilities. And they had some group homes. They still have some group homes throughout Burnaby. And they decided to redevelop their property. We helped with feasibility work early on for them, exploring various properties and which one would be best suited and what their options were. And in the end, they decided to redevelop the property that they were on, which had a series of program spaces, and because they offer day programs for people that are living in the community that have developmental disabilities, but they come in and access those services. But in addition to that, there's group homes and people that they work with throughout the community. And so this project is intended to bring together both the housing and the program spaces. And there's three group homes in it for people that can't live independently at all. They have they need full-time care, live-in care. And so there's these three group homes in this project. In addition to that, there's 39 more homes that are for people that are living semi-independently. So they can largely live on their own and they're in studios mostly with access to some programs and some support in the building, but mostly are doing their own thing. And then just regular rental, independent rental units. But that project altogether is really designed, intended to be an intentional community where people are living together with people that have some level of developmental disability, and others that are living together in community. And it's a beautiful, beautiful concept and a terrific model that is taking us away from a model of group homes and communities in a single detached home. We no longer have the ability to do that successfully because, you know, single detached homes are not necessarily the best use of land. So if we're doing multi-unit projects, there's this opportunity to bring people together. And the project was built with support, and why I one of the reasons I brought this up is that TL Housing Solutions, which is sort of the non-market arm of Townline, you know Townline quite well, they were the design build contractors for that project. And so they managed like the early part of the project. They were really like helping drive it forward and managed all the approvals and entitlements for the project. But it was funded through BC Housing as a primary funder. And it was funded through a program that is available still today, the Community Housing Fund, but really is not a great fit for that program as such. But we were able to make that work. But in addition to that, there was City of Burnaby support in terms of waivers and of their municipal fees and offsite costs, so they were a significant partner. And then as well, we had Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, CMHC, funding on top of that. So if you can imagine the complexity of that capital stack and then all of the partnerships. In addition, because there was such a significant non-residential portion to the building, the society had to fundraise, and they were able to fundraise at the last moment, $6 million. And so putting all that together was quite elaborate, but I highly recommend you check it out if you can. It is architecturally stunning. It's a very complex building, but beautiful in every sense. And I think it's a good example of what nonprofits can do and what a difference in community it can make.
We've had Rick and Daryl from Townline both on the program. And something actually that just stands out is I know that that's part of their portfolio seems to be really directed towards nonprofit housing now. And from my understanding of our conversation, it seems to be a growing area in the company. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you're seeing more developers kind of devote more time to? And can you maybe talk about, and maybe not from the developer perspective, maybe from the why are municipalities pushing so hard? And is this going to be a continued kind of focus for the next few decades in building in the region?
One of the biggest challenges, so municipalities play a critical role in my mind. They have had to deal with the crisis of the housing crisis and the homelessness crisis firsthand. They're seeing it. They're at the face of it. They're the front line in many senses. And, you know, historically, there was this notion that it's this senior levels of government space, but that's no longer the case. Every municipality has to prepare a housing needs report by the end of the year, and then within every 5 years to be updating their housing needs reports. And so in doing that exercise, they identify the need for households at different income brackets, and they have to then look at their OCPs and update their OCPs to integrate with the results of those reports. And they also may or may not have access to federal dollars and so on to help them address the increase in supply. So they've got this situation both provincially and federally where they're at the front line. So at all levels, they're seeing the problem, and they have an opportunity and an obligation in my mind to respond. So what can municipalities do though? They have, you know, only so many tools in the toolbox. And there are a combination of carrots and sticks that they'll draw on. But the inclusionary housing policy is really what you're seeing firsthand from a private sector perspective. So developers, if they're working on a major project, increasingly they're being asked to build the units directly, not just build affordable housing, not just a cash in lieu as it used to be before, or other kinds of community amenity contributions. Now these amenity contributions can be known up front, so they can be factored in the cost of the land. All of this can be factored in at the beginning in terms of at the acquisition stage. But it is becoming more and more of a requirement. Some of the larger municipalities have a significant push to get more non-market housing or nonprofit housing. And so developers are having to figure this out. What's going to work for each project? What's going to work for the project? Make sure that the project will pencil. We know it's really difficult to build rental housing right now. The viability of those projects is constrained, but you can work with each project and each site to try and figure out how to build it. And I think there is a, you know, I know there's lots of thoughts around those challenges and how it's going to impact affordability overall. But if we step back and look at the limited land supply available to the nonprofit housing sector, this is one of the ways that we can try and address that shortfall. So nonprofits, when they're looking at their pro forma, there's rarely the space to have a land component in that in the pro forma to make it work. there's no opportunity to debt service your project and have a land cost given land values in the city today. Many years ago, when I started out, perhaps there was some room for that, but today that's no longer the case, and given the lower revenue. So that's one way for us to try and create nonprofit housing projects.
Hey, everyone. Pardon the interruption. We just want to take a quick minute to thank the following sponsors who make this show possible.
We are also sponsored by Oakland Realty. This is our real estate brokerage, best brokerage in the city, hands down. If you are in the industry, a new agent, an aspiring agent, somebody just looking to make a change, new culture, new energy, new resources, head over to oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. That's oakland.com/join, type in VRP 2020. Not only do you get to meet Michael Morgan and the gang, the bigwigs over at Oakland, you get a huge incentive for first going to oakland.com/join, typing in VRP 2020.
Do you find are all municipalities kind of moving in lockstep in this regard, or is it kind of like there's a standout in terms of who's doing it, who's doing this best?
I don't know about best, but I think you see it's politically driven most of the time. I mean, you need a champion that's a really big proponent of affordable housing, and you see that some municipalities really really push for this. There's municipalities throughout the province that have been looking at housing and homelessness issues and are really pushing for it more and more compared to others. Burnaby is known for this now. Ironically, I remember the days where that wasn't a big focus at Burnaby, but it's definitely shifted in recent years. And others as well, New West, and now even Surrey's joined the group. Surrey's really looking hard at how to leverage opportunities and to create opportunities for affordable housing. And to be honest, I think a big part of it is because they're seeing the crisis firsthand. So they have to do something. And the question is, you know, how much can they push, and what are the mix of regulatory and incentives, combination of regulations and incentives that they need to put in place to keep building more, both on the rent market and non-market rental side, without really jeopardizing the viability of rental overall. Because there's always that risk as well, that if you're too stringent with your regulations, that developers will walk away from those projects or put them on pause.
Yeah, and we're seeing that. I mean, we just had Derek Fluker on from West Group, and one of the conversations we were having is around the unintended consequences of some of the DCCs and taxes and changes to capital gains tax recently at the federal level. And, you know, I mean, I think the example, I've actually got it here. The example was in one case study, they showed how there would have been a benefit to the community of $166 million that they decided actually just, it was more profitable to keep the existing mini mall, essentially, where the site was. And they decided it was, and so the community that therefore then benefits from nothing, you know, 100% of nothing. So I guess, can you talk about some of the friction and where is the friction around delivering nonprofit housing?
So for us, there's different ways to answer that. I think for nonprofit housing, there's a lot of stigma around that. And I think that's one of the major issues is neighborhoods are concerned about changing nature of their communities. If nonprofit housing is coming in, what does that mean for our neighborhoods? There's that. And developers, I think, have some of those same fears as well. It's how would we integrate that into the project? Even if there is the opportunity to do significant density and the cost of the deal will work, there's still that concern at the end of the day that there's going to be this integration with non-market housing residents. And what does that look like for my project, and how's that going to shape our project? And I think trying to overcome that, the more we talk about those positive experiences and those positive partnerships, the more normalized it will become. And you know, for us, we've worked on projects all over the province where that often what happens with nonprofit housing is it's more expensive to build. It's much more complex to build because there's a mix of units. And there's very specific dreams and aspirations of that nonprofit. And so they're architecturally beautiful and they fit in the neighborhood and help revitalize the neighborhood. And so they, you know, I think talking about those examples of really positive experiences of how well integrated those projects are in specific neighborhoods is one way to overcome that. And then also those positive partnerships. I dropped a line to Byron Chard and Brenda Ulmer from the YWCA because they've got several projects together. So the YWCA and Chard have partnered on quite a few now, and they've got a lot of those lessons learned around how to make those projects work, how to build those partnerships. And it's mutually beneficial, and it's something that those neighborhoods and those communities are benefiting. And the developer is also benefiting in that there's good optics around having that affordable housing as part of your project. And you're also meeting the requirements of the municipality to do mixed tenure inclusionary housing. So I think there's great examples out there that we should, you know, be showcasing and talking about. And then eventually over time, it'll, you know, we're all, a few people want to be the first ones, right? We're always looking to draw on other people's experiences. Nobody wants to be the guinea pig.
Can we talk about some examples of partnerships that worked well? Like you mentioned Byron Chard, I feel like, man, in terms of guys that come up on the show often for the good work they're doing, Byron is one of those names that always pops up. But yeah, can you talk about some examples of partnerships that worked well?
So I think what you should do, I think you should bring Byron and Brenda on the show together one time and they could walk you through this.
He's got to come back on soon. He hasn't been on in a while.
Yeah. Because I think that there's elements for sure about bringing those groups together and being successful. That element of bringing a nonprofit in early is one of the key things. I actually think that a lot of developers are struggling to do this. They explore it, they look into it, and then it's outside their comfort zone. And so they walk away from those opportunities. And I do think we need to be talking about those one-offs that are out there, like the Byron Y partnership more and more, because there is lessons that we can learn from those projects. Where I think we've not done a good job is municipalities that are building projects themselves or like initiating projects themselves, or they're acquiring that inclusionary housing piece and the nonprofit comes in at the last minute. And in those situations, a lot of post-occupancy challenges will happen and it makes it much more challenging to build the deal in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you also miss out on potential opportunities for funding and financing as well through that. I don't know how much, we haven't really talked about the programs that are out there, but the market, the landscape has changed in the funding world. Nonprofits have a lot of work to do to make their projects happen. And if they're involved early, there could be a potential to access some of those resources out there. But they have to compete. They have to compete for the dollars. If there's provincial funding, there's hoops and applications to fill out. If it's federal, the same. And then beyond that, if they have to do any fundraising themselves to make the project work. Because if you can imagine, like we're dealing with mixed income projects for the nonprofits more and more. They're rarely a one size fits all. They're more and more. You're seeing the programs today are requiring a mix of rent levels, but within that mix of rent levels, if there's a grant that's available through a funding program, it is never enough to make a project whole. So there's still requirements for debt servicing the project in terms of debt coverage. So the nonprofit has to seek out additional sources of funding to round out their pro forma to make it to. So you'd have, I use the example of L'Arche, but I think it's fairly common that there every project that we're working on that gets BC housing funding, for example, we've been seeking out additional sources of funding, CMHC and otherwise, to help achieve that debt coverage ratio that they need to achieve for the long-term financing. And they might have access to, you know, better terms in their construction financing or in their takeout mortgage costs, but they're still trying to make it work with lower rents and, you know, reduced revenue compared to market. So if you think about all of the challenges that the nonprofits are trying to manage, in order for them to, you need to be involved early in a project in order to have the opportunity to explore all of that and try and build your project. And then there's the possibility for a purchase from or a partnership of sorts with a developer.
Noah, to what extent has the nonprofit housing housing developments helped alleviate Vancouver's housing crisis?
Pretty tall order. I think nonprofits have done the best job that they possibly can, but it's tough to frame it as a nonprofit housing. The nonprofit, it's not from a lack of trying, let me put it that way, that they haven't addressed, alleviated the crisis. And we've already mentioned that there was the funding programs that were available in the 70s and 80s completely dried up in the 90s. There was you know, one-off programs here and there. They were weak and they were small and there was very limited funding. And a lot of the nonprofits that had been developing housing for years and years and years really just became operators because there was no opportunity for new development. And that's started to change now. But in the meantime, what's happened, and I'm going to quote some numbers on the homelessness side, Metro Vancouver in 2023 had nearly 5,000 people that were counted that as experiencing homelessness. That's a significant number of people that were living outside or living in shelters on and off. And that's just Metro Vancouver. The similar patterns happening all over the province. So we have so much to catch up on. And maybe we should speak about that for a minute. Like, housing is more often than not a big part of that story. There's a lot of other elements too. But if you lose your job or you split up with your spouse or your landlord sells your home and you can't move out in your community, you could find yourself in that situation very easily. And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, this could be anybody that could end up in those situations. And housing is very much a big part of that. There's other pathways into homelessness too, but I think that's such a huge aspect of it is housing affordability. So, and even seniors, we do a lot of work in homelessness. We're working on the homelessness plan for, it was called the Homelessness Prevention and Response Plan for the city of Surrey last year. And the number of seniors and in our engagement as we're talking to groups that are among the homeless, the homelessness statistics, it's shocking that people that had never been homeless before in their elder years are finding themselves without a house, without a home, and they're ending up in the shelters. Same with families with young children. So I don't know if nonprofit housing has helped or hindered. They're doing what they can with the limited resources, but also we've got a lot of catch up to do. And even on the rental side, I've heard some of the people on this show talking about where rents have gone in recent years. Just this last year's numbers, so we rely on limited data that's out there, but the average rent in the region from 2023, so it'll be higher this year for sure, for units that are vacant and on the market was $2,144. I'm sure it's much higher today. But then if you compare that to what the region can afford, so what 44% of the region's households could not afford that rent without spending more than 30% of their income. If you look at 50% of their income, then you would have about 25% of all households are in this situation today. So imagine 25% of all households not being able to afford the average rent. Now, it's a very simplified statistic. Of course, it's, you know, it's averages, but it just gives a sense of the scale of the problem. And of course, some people are already in the rental market and their rents are lower, but what if they need to move? Or what if they lose their housing? You kind of get the picture. So we're really behind in terms of rental supply in general, but then in addition to it, there's a role for the nonprofits to address those lowest income households and specialized housing that we were talking about earlier. And I think to really hit home this point is like, if you think of the last year, I don't know if you've had a chance to, in your work, have looked at like Kijiji or Facebook Marketplace or whatever to see what rents are out there today. The gap between the older stock and the newer stock has seemed to have shrunk and shrunk. So if you're, you know, in some neighborhoods in the West End or wherever, a one bedroom that might be renting for $2,800 a month, it would be the same if it was a unit that was built in the 1960s or one that was built 2023 or very similar. And that
we've noticed
that's a real constraint. That's a real challenge that it's a scarcity issue. It's not about quality anymore.
And, right. And regionally as well. Like we've noticed the gap has narrowed between, say, like Vancouver and Abbotsford.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And that's because the same rental supply challenges are all over the region, but also because people have had to leave. They've been displaced from the big cities and the urban centers and they're moving elsewhere. And those same challenges are throughout the province, even in small communities in BC.
Yeah, and it's funny that it just makes me think we just had somebody on talking about the pre-construction market where the floor, the unit price has gone down in some markets, but the floor price, like the lowest price has actually gone up over the last year, which just, and it's kind of shrunk, like it's compressed the pricing.
Yeah.
Which is kind of in the same way, like a newer unit in the West End versus an older one. You know, that gap just doesn't exist anymore.
But that was how it used to be that you'd say, you know, the older stock is going to be your affordable housing in the future. So, you know, keep building more because in the future, that's going to be your affordable housing. But what's happened now because of the scarcity, the vacancy and the limited options available, it's that filtering isn't happening in the same way.
So Noha, I guess we're maybe as a final question, we're in this moment where it seems very hard to deliver housing and it only seems to be getting more challenging. You see maybe an incentive on one side and then potentially another, and on the other side, there's more of a money grab. It seems like there's a lot of vested interest in housing and it's very hard to deliver housing. How can we get to a place where, like in your mind, how does this pan out where we can actually see more housing delivered and at the same time see more affordable and nonprofit?
Like housing? All types of housing delivered.
All types, right? Of housing
delivered.
Because we
need delivered. All, I think you mentioned that scarcity idea, Noha, where it's like, the impacts on the rental market, it's like, yeah, how do we get to that place of all types of housing being delivered?
I think we all have a role to play, starting with the, you know, we just came off of an election and we know that it's a little bit of a different situation, but on the whole, the opportunities that municipalities have now to increase, I'm going to call it opportunities, increase density will, and to, for a lot of landowners and developers to build as a right 20 stories in certain areas and really help increase the supply, that we'll see over time, keeping in mind all the incentives, the challenges you're talking about around DCCs and other requirements and obligations, we will see, I think, an increase in supply. It's inevitable that we're going to have a response to that level of density because projects are more viable when you increase that in transit-oriented areas or otherwise. Like, you will start to see more rental housing being built. And that increase in supply inevitably will have a difference in affordability. But in addition to that, we're talking about the nonprofit portion that is not going to be built naturally through the private sector. There's a space for the nonprofit operators, this is their area of expertise. They are highly sophisticated, highly professionalized, and able to deliver these projects in whether they're doing that independently or in partnerships with the private sector. If we can really increase supply across the board, across the whole housing ecosystem, we will inevitably see a change in affordability. There's no question of that in my mind. That's what we need to do. So it's really about pushing for as much supply as possible, but recognizing that it can't all be market rental units that are, you know, being rented out at $3,000 a month. There has to be a range of unit sizes, unit options, but also the, you know, that focused subsidy and intervention on the nonprofit side as well. And it will make a difference. It will address our homelessness crisis over time, as well as like specialized housing that will help with some of those elements. So I think we're all trying to do the same thing, build more housing.
Right. No, it makes a lot of sense. And okay, well, Noha, we do have this segment called the Five Wire, five lighthearted questions we end every show with. Can you stick around for that?
I can.
This podcast is brought to you by Spark, the new development sales and marketing platform.
Adam, the stakes have never been higher for launching a condo project, and today's developers and brokerage teams need to leverage the best tools in order to hit their financing thresholds and to sell out their projects.
Spark is an all-in-one sales and marketing software that includes a comprehensive CRM, inventory management, email marketing, and digital contracts. These tools are custom tailored to the pre-sale process to help you capture leads, increase inventory yield, and transact contracts seamlessly.
And here's the best part, Adam. Spark's team is headquartered right here in Yale Town, and they have over 10 years of experience in helping BC-based developers and brokers bring their projects to market.
So if you're selling a new development, you need to check out Spark at spark.re/VREP. That's spark.re/VREP. And remember, Matt, you can't light the pre-sale world on fire without a spark. Question number one is one book that you've read recently that you would recommend for our listeners.
Okay. So I made a valiant effort. I knew this was coming. I'll do my best. So I am reading again. I have little kids. So for a while there, it felt impossible to read. But I've actually been really, really enjoying getting back to reading. It's been a great shift for me. And I read a book over the summer. And now I like fiction and nonfiction and all the things, although I tend to enjoy historical fiction. And there's a terrific book I read that is fiction set in Pennsylvania in the 1930s called Heaven and Earth Grocery Store by James McBride. And it's just such a terrific escape, but also the voices of the characters. For me, it's the storytelling. It's about being engaged in the story and, you know, you're transported to a different place. So that book did that very much for me, but also really talked about privilege and bigotry and all of those things at a time where, at a different time and place. So yeah, highly recommend that.
Right, but Great Depression era, mm-hmm. Depression era Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Very different from children's books, which I'm still reading. Sorry, I digress. That sounds like a great recommendation.
Yeah, highly recommend.
Perfect.
In the last few years, what new belief, behavior, or habit has most improved your life? And with young kids, it's usually tough. So looking forward to this one.
Well, actually, I focused on kind of a more of a business-focused decision behavior. So as a new, relatively new, I guess not that new anymore, but I still sort of see it as being fairly fresh. One of the things that I learned as a new business owner is that when we took on ownership of the business, Jada and I, we realized pretty quickly that we can't be good at everything. And it's tough. You can't succeed on your own. And we really had the greatest success when we were drawing on the talent that was around us. There is some inherent leadership or experience or knowledge from different people on the team. And we have such an amazing group of professionals in the firm and a fantastic leadership team. And we're such a small boutique firm that I'm pretty niche in itself that we really need to draw on that internally, but also externally. There's experts that we'll turn to outside the firm for, you know, for various things, for advice whenever we need it. And otherwise, I think that's been a big learning for me is just you could always seek advice elsewhere. Don't always try and figure it out on your own or take it all on your own. And that's been a really big help for us as we go on this journey of being small business owners.
And how many people in City Spaces now?
I think we're about 20 of us in Vancouver and then folks that are in various other places. So it's about 25.
Great.
So it's grown quite a bit from two.
from your 100, original 100% growth.
Definitely.
Question number three, what have you been binge watching lately, or a movie recommendation?
This is my least favorite one because here's the story. So whenever my partner and I have the time and want to indulge in watching something, we spend all of our time surfing channels, surfing the streaming options out there and to try and figure out what to watch. Then we eventually give up and don't watch anything at all. So what have you been watching? Maybe we could take your recommendation.
We do the same thing in my house.
Exactly. You know what? And there's the thing about, it's like from the 80s, so many channels and nothing's on.
Yeah.
I feel like it's something that's been going on for a long time. But
yeah. I take recommendations.
Matt, question
Adam,
four.
Recommendation? No, I've been rewatching Mad Men, which has been great. It started over 20 years ago, which I couldn't believe.
I don't think our recommendations have changed since Sopranos and Mad Men.
It's always
pretty consistent.
I did like Mad Men. I watched some of that.
Mm-hmm. Favorite band or music?
So it's about really the right music for each experience. So I like to listen to sort of mellow music on Sunday mornings or cooking dinner music. Got a goofy playlist for with the kids called Kitchen Party, and we'll dance around the kitchen while cooking dinner. You know, that's my vibe. It's about the experience. But to be honest, I have little kids. I have an 8-year-old and a 12-year-old, and I'm probably listening mostly to what they want. My 8-year-old wants to listen to the Minions playlist. There's a bit of Taylor Swift for my 12-year-old, but she's really into Olivia Rodrigo and Sabrina Carpenter. And so that's what we get the most of that right now. Eventually we'll get to diversify, but yeah, they get to call the shots more than anything.
Sounds familiar.
That's great. And as a final question, something you've purchased for under $1,500 that's had a positive impact on your life?
I guess it's a funny question. I'm pretty fortunate. I come from a place of, privilege. I've got a comfortable home. For me, I really like experiences more than stuff. I like to travel and spend time with friends. That's kind of my thing. So when I thought about this one, I went back to the question around the book. I realized I was having trouble reading. So I've been reading so much more. And I went and got my eyes checked and I got new prescription reading glasses that have been amazing because I can...
Life-changing.
It's been life-changing. But it's more about the opportunity to relax and unwind and close your day out with a good book and get a break. And so as a business owner and a mom with two kids, that time is pretty critical. So I've been really appreciating that.
Fantastic. Great advice for everyone out there, actually. Make sure you get your eyes checked.
Was that the advice, Matt?
I took the wrong thing away from that.
No, whatever works for you.
Noah, how can people find out more about what you're up to and, of course, City Spaces?
Well, we are online. We're cityspaces.ca. You can find us. We've got a website with contact info. You can always email or phone me. If you're interested in doing a deal with a nonprofit, or you've got questions around how to do that, or anything really planning and development related, feel free to give me a shout.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Noha. And have to have you back.
Sounds good.
So there you have it, folks, our discussion with Noha Sedki from City Spaces. And really enjoyed that conversation.
Yeah, I feel like there's... It's something this is what we're trying to get better on in the show, but something that comes up on a regular basis, but we never really talk about, it always feels like a passing point in a conversation and then we move on. But it's good to actually go deep on this because, like I said, if you're a pre-sale buyer, chances are there's going to be a nonprofit housing component to the project. And if you're an agent or in the industry, this is going to be something that you're already seeing, but you're going to be seeing more of. So
well, yeah,
best to understand it.
And not only pre-sale, right? Like this is, you know, this is for years, you know, there's these, you think of the Jervis on Davie and that
sure.
The whole debacle about separate doors back was years ago now. Like this is an ongoing conversation. And that's just one segment, of course, because as Noha demonstrated, the nonprofit sector is vast and it's an area of housing that I will admit I don't know much about, but that was really enlightening. So glad to have Noha on, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, we'll have to have Noha back in the future to keep us posted on further developments and further insights. So
absolutely. And total aside, and you have me curious because you mentioned something right before we went live about your sleep.
I had a really good sleep. You know what? It's funny, but I think I can't remember where I heard this, but I think it was like a Huberman or something, but I've been doing it lately and I'm falling asleep so fast. It's so here's the idea and give it a shot, Matt. And if you're at home and you haven't heard this, it's
right.
worth checking out. So right before you, when you're lying down, going to sleep, often what happens apparently, and this is like what it's based on, but when you're about to fall asleep, often you feel like you're thinking really random thoughts. Do you ever get that? Like where you have really kind of right before you're about to fall asleep.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like kind of think where it's almost like really weird thoughts. So the idea is you think about any word. So think about like, here, think about a word. Let's do an exercise right now. This is putting everybody to sleep. So it's working.
Okay, I got one.
Here, what is it? Tell us.
The word?
Yeah. What did I just ask here? Pig? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So pig, you think about pig in your head and then you take the last letter of the word and which is G. And now you think of something else.
That starts with G.
Yeah.
Okay. Give.
Give. Okay. And then E is because the last letter of E. And you just
keep doing this. Egg.
You just keep doing that egg and you just keep doing that. And I'm promising you'll fall asleep really, really quickly because what
Glory.
It is doing is replicating random thoughts, which happen right before you fall asleep. So anyways, I've been doing this lately and it's like I'm asleep once I hit the pill. So,
wow. Interesting.
Full of life hacks. This is.
Wow. Okay. All right. All right. Great. Well, what else do we have before we've all fall asleep?
Before we put everybody to sleep. Yeah.
We have VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. This is our website where all things real estate related live. Head over to VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com for things like the LiveWire. You know, we might even integrate SkyTrain Condo Living into the LiveWire because we do have VIP access to pre-sale projects on the LiveWire. But of course, it really makes sense to kind of refocus along SkyTrain lines. So that will be forthcoming. We also have stats, different types of stats, sales ratios. You can delve into neighborhoods and go into certain price points to see how things are selling. It's very granular level detail on the LiveWire. We also have deal of the month. And of course, tried and true, private client services.
Because Matt, if you are not using PCS, you are standing still while the rest of us power walk by. You get sold prices, days on market. You basically get realtor level information for free. It's available at your fingertips over at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com. We are coming up on, the last month of the year here in a few days. Probably a good time to be monitoring. I don't think we're going to have a ton of new inventory coming this month. But sales volume seems to be...
What does absorption look like, though?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting time to be monitoring. But what you want to really... You want to have that set up so you start to see sold prices and then you can kind of monitor what's happening with new listings and activity when the new year hits. And there's always a bit of a lag period. We're probably talking more towards mid-end of January where we're going to start to see industry when everybody... Or when we start to see inventory, I should say, increase. And, you know, there's always a bit of a Christmas hangover in the market. But yeah, what a time to get set up. Get your ducks in a row.
Get your ducks in a row. Get your goals for 2025 sorted. Which, are we going to do a goals show?
We should do a goals show. I was thinking about that. We'll do maybe a panel and maybe a goals show. But we've got a few episodes we've got to get out before the new year here.
All right. Well, if you want to talk about that or anything else, you can try me at 778-847-2854 or Matt at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
Or you can try me at 778-866-4574 or Adam at VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
And of course, we got that Kokomo line, info@VancouverRealEstatePodcast.com.
We'll have a great week and back here next week with another great episode.
Take care.
2000 Spaces for Radio. Subscribe today.